From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We're going to take a look at this week's political news in the wake of elections and talk to the next majority leader of the state Senate.
You know, so everything that requires us to remove obstacles for capital investment is exactly what we're going to be focusing on.
We'll talk to someone who researches decomposition.
The necrobiome is this community of organisms that has evolved to recycle organic matter and nutrients for us around the globe.
This Sunday, Veterans Day marks the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. We'll hear from some of the men who fought there. And it's fall, it's the weekend. We're going to make a cocktail with an ingredient I really wouldn't have guessed the Cheers team would use.
Rustic Crow Distillery from Dearborn has one that I really, really like.
We'll see. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The transition of power at the Capitol continued yesterday. State legislators chose new leadership. As all of this power changes hands, what could possibly go wrong? Joining us now are our Friday political commentators. Ken Sikkema is Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Majority Leader of the State Senate. Vicki Barnett is a former Mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic Legislator in Lansing. Well, anything interesting happened in Michigan politics this week?
Other than an election?
Yeah, seriously. I was at the Public Sector Consultants Pundit Summit yesterday, and Governor-elect Gretchen Whitmer's people were saying Governor Snyder's team is working really well with them to make the transition as smooth as possible. For the first time since Governor Engler, we're going to have a governor in office who has legislative experience. How much of a difference will that make in how well the legislative and executive branches work together, Ken?
Oh, I think it'll make an enormous difference. You know, this situation of a newly elected Democratic governor and Republican House and Senate is the result of the election of 16 years ago when Jennifer Granholm was first elected governor in 2002. And I think the big difference between then and now, one of the big differences, is that Governor-elect Whitmer does come out of the legislature, and it just helps enormously. She understands it. She's used to the sort of give and take. She's used to the sort of the bombs that get thrown occasionally rhetorically, and that's not going to phase her much. So I think it stands both her, the legislature, and the state of Michigan in good stead.
Vicki, Governor-elect Whitmer says she'll make it a priority to talk with the legislative leaders, bringing back the so-called quadrant meetings, meaning the Senate majority and minority leaders, the Speaker of the House and minority leader. How useful are those kinds of meetings between the legislative leaders and the governor?
I think they're hugely important, especially since we have divided government right now. And getting back to what you said about Gretchen having experience in the legislature, she not only has experience, but she has experience as a minority leader with an obstructionist majority leader in the Senate. So she's used to finding her way through that kind of rough surface area to come up with some positive plans. And I think the quadrant meetings, the communication between the executive and the leadership in the House and Senate, both the majority and minority, that's part of the problem. There's been a lack of communication of shared priorities, and bringing back those meetings will help smooth that out. I am concerned, however, that the incoming Senate Majority Leader, Mike Shirkey, says he's not sure he wants to participate.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because the Senate and House have elected their leaders, as you said. In the Senate, Mike Shirkey has been elected Majority Leader. In the House, Representative Lee Chatfield will be Speaker of the next session. The minority leaders are Christine Gregg of Farmington Hills, Vicki, your
yes.
state rep, and the Senate Minority Leader will once again be Jim Ananick. Ken, what do you think of those choices?
Well, every caucus in every session is unique to itself. And I think these leaders, it's always good to get advice from past leaders, but really at the end of the day, they have to be comfortable in their own skin. And that's what will make them successful. I'm not a huge fan of the quadrant meetings. I think they can help. They're not going to be a replacement, though, for the kind of one-on-one that the governor-elect will have to have with a majority leader or with the speaker, for example. That's going to happen a lot, aside from the quadrant meetings.
If, as Vicki says, Mike Shirkey isn't interested in participating in those meetings, is that a mistake or is that just him going his own way?
Well, I haven't seen any comment that he said he wouldn't participate. He said he was a little bit more measured. He said he wanted to think about it. At the end of the day, if the governor invites you to a meeting, you tend to go to a meeting. But once again, having a meeting for a meeting's sake doesn't add value. There's going to have to be a lot of one-on-one conversations with all the leaders and the governor when it comes to particular and specific pieces of legislation or budget items.
Vicki, what do you think of these choices in leadership?
Well, I think that they were all fairly expected. The only real concern was what was going to happen in the state house on the Democratic side, where there was a real challenge between Chris Gregg and Representative Brian Elder from Saginaw, and Chris Gregg won out. And that was in large part due to the fact that the caucus knows her and that there was this huge influx of women. Again, the Republicans have nominated most of their leadership teams are men. On the Democratic side, that's a little different, with Stephanie Chang as the floor leader, minority floor leader in the Senate, and Chris Gregg being the minority leader in the state house. I want to get back to the quadrant meetings for a moment, because I don't like meetings for meeting's sake. But we have divided government, and we have very strong opinions on both sides of the aisle. To start to have a conversation where people get to know each other and can talk about their goals and hopes and dreams for the state of Michigan and try to find some common ground in a five-way meeting, to me, makes a lot of sense to find out where everybody's coming from, to try to learn how to negotiate the best way possible. That is no replacement for one-on-one meetings, nor is it a replacement for the governor to sit down and meet with the committee chairs and vice chairs to find out what's on their minds. And I'm hoping there's a lot of touchy-feely stuff to really get to know each other, which is difficult to do in a term-limited environment, but something that has been so necessary and so missing. And I hope that we have a change in tone coming out of Lansing.
Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. You can hear them most Fridays here on Stateside. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Well, as we've been talking about, the state legislature elected its leaders for the next session. Republican Lee Chatfield will be Speaker of the House. The new majority leader will be Republican Senator Mike Shirkey, and he joins us now. Welcome. Congratulations.
Thank you, Lester. Privilege to be with you.
So what will your priorities be in the coming session?
We're going to continue the priorities that we've had the last 8 years, and that is to ensure that Michigan remains competitive and attracts talent and capital. You know, so everything that requires us to remove obstacles for capital investment is exactly what we're going to be focusing on.
Governor-elect Gretchen Whitmer is talking about regular meetings with the four legislative leaders, known as the quadrant. What do you think of reviving that practice?
I think that'd be a good start and demonstrate that all parties are interested in working together, and I'd be happy to participate.
Do you think you can get some real work done in that kind of a meeting?
Well, the first thing is to get together and get to know each other. Right now, there's a group of people that Representative Chatfield and I know each other well, but I can't say that we know the rest of them very well.
Well, you did serve with Governor-elect Whitmer. She used to be the minority leader in the Senate. Did you get along with her?
Never had much interaction. Was observed her from a distance. I was in the House at the time, and so I can say that we say good morning to each other when we pass in the hall, but we really have never had any in-depth conversation.
Jim Ananick is the minority leader in the Senate. Have you had much conversation with him?
Yeah, Jim's actually a good friend, and I've known Jim for a long time, and we've always worked well together, and I expect that to continue.
I want to ask you about some of the logistics. Former Senate Majority Leader Ken Sikkema has told me that sometimes he had to shepherd through things he really didn't like, but his caucus insisted on it. How do you plan on handling something like that?
Well, I think that Ken represents the attitude that I kind of bring to the table as well. We spend far too much time, in my opinion anyway, working on things that maybe feel good but may not have the impact that people expect. And so I'm expecting our committee chairs to be good stewards in their committees and lead the conversations and ensure that things that get out of committee are things that really can move the needle and contribute to Michigan becoming a more competitive and relevant state in our nation.
Do you have some specific ideas in mind?
Well, one of the areas that I think we can focus on is in the education field, just removing obstacles and lifting the burden of layering on and layering on of requirements and regulation and doing a review, I call it oversight, of the kinds of things that we've done in the past, and those things that are working continue and support them, and those things that aren't working, let's peel them off. And so we create more freedom and opportunity for teachers to spend more time actually teaching.
What kind of obstacles are you talking about?
You know, there's a lot of layering in the education field of reports and reporting. Some of them are duplicative and some of them are redundant. And so that's a good start right there.
Any other major moves that you want to make or see in the first session?
I think that the entire state of Michigan expects us all to lock arms and work together to come up with a solution that makes our auto insurance more affordable. And we've got some very specific ideas there, and I'm looking forward to engaging in that conversation.
Well, we got a second or two here. Can you tell us what you have in mind for auto insurance?
Well, I think that we have to reevaluate the notion that there are no choices that drivers and automobile operators have when they're selecting auto insurance. That is the first place to start. And then on the cost structure side, I think there's some sanity that we can imply in there. And some of the bills that we've already passed in the Senate, I think, are a good start. And that'll be the foundation for us moving forward.
We've been watching with some interest in Wisconsin in the lame duck session. The Republican-led legislature is doing everything it can to curtail the powers of the incoming Democratic governor. That's something that happened in North Carolina a couple of years ago. How likely is it that the lame duck session of the Michigan legislature would do something like that?
Well, I think our initial focus will be to evaluate and take up some amendments to the minimum wage and paid sick leave citizen initiatives that we adopted earlier in the fall. And beyond that, I know that the Senate Majority Leader Meekhoff has got a team working on a long list of priorities that, frankly, I've been too busy trying to make sure that we brought back a majority in the Senate. And so I haven't been brought into those conversations yet, but I'm sure it's going to be a robust lame duck between now and the end of the year.
So I'm not sure whether that gets to whether you're going to try to curtail the new governor's power or not.
No, I don't think there's a purposeful intent to do so, but I think there is a purposeful intent to make sure that we're not setting ourselves up for the kinds of things that would send signals to the rest of the world that Michigan's not a friendly place to work and to play and to live.
Senator Mike Shirky will be the new Senate Majority Leader during the next session of the legislature. Thanks for taking the time.
You're welcome, Lester. Take care.
Coming up, we'll talk with a scientist who researches the life that comes from death. Also, ahead of the 100th anniversary of Armistice Day, we reach into the archives and pull out some interviews I did with veterans of World War I. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Well, I don't know about you, but it's the weekend. I think it's time for a drink.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon of Tammy's Tastings. You've got your copper mug out, which generally means something to do with a Moscow mule.
Right, which uses vodka, which, as you and I talked about last time, isn't my favorite spirit. But this time we're going to use another spirit that's in a category that I don't normally drink very much from either.
All right, I can't imagine what other spirit you're avoiding.
Well, so generally, I'm not very interested in flavored spirits.
Oh, yeah. I see them on the shelf at my grocery store, and I think, who's buying this?
Right. But Rusted Crow Distillery from Dearborn has one that I really, really like. It's called Ginger Devil, and it's a cinnamon whiskey. And that, you know, brings to mind visions of Fireball and, you know, makes me a little scared. But when I took my first sip, I was like, oh, no, they're doing something really refined here. It's not over the top. It's not in your face. It's just really good.
Well, I'll have to take your word for it until I get a sip of your cocktail here. But I've always wondered, do they age these things in the barrel and then mix in some, like, cinnamon syrup, or do they put everything in the barrel and let it age together?
So I asked Andrew Starnes, who's the distiller at Rusted Crow, and he said that this includes three different types of cinnamon, ginger root, graham crackers, lemon peel, orange peel, and clove, and that they put all those botanicals in before they age it. So that goes in into the whiskey, and then I assume all gets strained out, and then that spice product goes into barrels for about 4 months, and then this is slightly sweetened, so it has some cinnamon syrup added after it comes out of the barrel.
I was afraid it was all coming out of one big like wine box thing and flavoring it. It's good to know that at least there's some thought put into it.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, what is the drink in which we're using Ginger Devil?
I just wanted to go simple with this. I talked to Andrew about it, and he said that he thought it paired really well with apple cider, and it paired really well with ginger beer. And I thought, oh, I know how to put those things together. So I've created just a simple apple cinnamon mule. So I started with 2 ounces of the Rusted Crow Ginger Devil spiced whiskey. And then I added to that 1 ounce of apple cider, 1/2 ounce of lemon juice, 8 drops or so of the smoked apple chicory bitters from Black Ink Bitters, and then topped it all off with 3 ounces of ginger beer in a Moscow Mule mug over ice.
Okay, let's back up a little bit. Black Ink Bitters, last time we talked about them, they were just getting started, right?
Right. They started off as a Kickstarter, and the Kickstarter didn't even fund, but the company did go on to go into production, and they've come up with a great line of bitters. My favorite are these smoked apple chicory ones.
Well, I love to taste bitters, but of course, you know, I want to take a drink of your cocktail, but I'm a little enthused about these, so I'm going to take a drop of this and put it on the back of my hand and just take a taste of it. You hold my microphone.
That is the best way to taste bitters.
Wow.
Aren't those delicious?
They really are. I'm surprised. Because bitters usually are bracing and really hard. Even a drop of them on your tongue is a lot. It's overwhelming. But that was actually a really pleasant experience.
So that's a little bit of a blessing and a curse, because those bitters that taste so overpowering when you taste them on their own, when you put them into a cocktail, just a small amount can really come through. With these, because they are a little bit gentler, you need to use more of them in the drink to really taste the bitters in the finished drink.
All right, let me take a taste of this. Copper mugs get so icy cold. You can definitely taste the cinnamon from both the bitters and the whiskey. But I was kind of expecting that kind of cloying sort of cinnamon taste out of the whiskey, but that's not what's happening here at all.
Right. It's not red hot cinnamon like we think of with Fireball. It's actual cinnamon, and it tastes like actual cinnamon, plus the ginger and the other ingredients. That's why I say it's really nuanced for a spiced whiskey.
I'll have to take a taste of that on its own sometime. Thanks very much for the drink.
Cheers.
Well, we live in Michigan, so just about all of us have seen a dead deer alongside the road. Some of us have smelled a dead deer along the road, and if you're like me, you might be thinking, hope somebody cleans that up soon. Well, Eric Benbow thinks about decomposition a little differently. He studies it and the life that results from death. He's a forensic entomologist and a microbial ecologist who led a study at Michigan State University. It established a baseline of the life that benefits from the decomposition of plants and animals. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
So you call the organisms that benefit from a carcass necrobiome. What kinds of animals and organisms are we talking about?
So your body is housed, or houses actually, huge numbers of bacteria and other microbial species and taxa that are really important to your health in many ways. If you think about the gut microbiome and all of the influences it has on human health. And so there's already organisms residing in your body that when you die, or any organisms die, everything changes, right? The blood flow, the oxygen concentrations, and those microbes begin to proliferate in ways that we're just beginning to understand. But also those microbes we think are responsible for attracting other decomposers, such as insects, that have evolved to locate something dead and use it not only as a habitat, but also as a food resource for their offspring. But in the meantime, the same volatiles or the same odors that are being given off by the microbes also attract vertebrate scavengers like raccoons, like coyotes, different parts of the country. It's going to be bears and a lot of avian scavengers and vultures. And so it's the entire community of organisms that ultimately are responsible for recycling those nutrients and recycling the energy that's in each and every one of our bodies but also in all of the other animal bodies that are out there.
When I was looking at what you're studying, I remembered that someone once told me there's more life in a dead tree than there is in a live tree. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah. So the decomposition of both animal and plant matter, they follow different trajectories in many ways, but what they offer is a new food resource subsidy that new organisms, whether they're microbes, bacteria, or fungi, or invertebrates, they begin to consume and recycle that biomass and the energy and the nutrients. And the necrobiome is this community of organisms that has evolved to recycle organic matter and nutrients for us around the globe.
So the recyclers, how important are they to life on Earth?
Well, imagine if you walked outside and anything that died did not disappear, right? We think about it as disappearing. The necrobiome essentially recycles that so quickly, we don't even realize that things die in nature sometimes. But imagine if human catastrophe or a huge mass mortality event of reindeer, for instance, that happened in Northern Europe, when those carcasses are out there, if they did not disappear, one, we wouldn't get new nutrients back into the ecosystems, but two, the energy flow would be captured in those carcasses as well. And that has disrupting effects on ecosystems that we don't even understand yet, because the recyclers are so efficient at what they do, we don't have to. And that's the understudied part of decomposition in many parts of the world.
I was looking at your bio and it said that you think the decomposition process and its effects on other life have not been very well researched until now, but there might be human health applications and things like that. What kind of things are you looking at and how would they be helpful?
Decomposition itself is a dynamic process. We're trying to understand which decomposers are really good at it. The human health implications, in terms of my interest and some of my colleagues of mine, are there are certain insects that decompose not only animal matter, but also plant matter. And so if you think about the organic waste that go into pre-consumer food waste, when you buy those nice packages of fruit at the grocery store, well, they used to have skins on them. And where did the skin go? Did it go to the landfill? Or in many cases, it can be recycled by certain insects. And then those insects that live on that matter, they convert that energy, convert those nutrients from the original plant matter into their larval bodies. What we can do there is dry those bodies and then sell them to the pet industry, or in other parts of the world, you feed them directly to chickens or to swine. And so you're recycling your food waste into something that has a value-added component that then can be used to improve food production in a way that we really need to on a global scale.
All right, I have to ask you one personal question. How did you become interested in studying the decay, the decomposition of dead things?
I had a tremendous mentor, Rich Merritt, who is an emeritus professor from Michigan State University. He got me into forensic entomology, and his background was actually understanding how dung was recycled by certain insects that have evolved to recycle and use dung. So he let me get in on a couple of forensic cases, and the science behind it was very similar to what I had studied for my PhD, which was the life cycle and energetics of an insect.
Eric Benbow is an associate professor of entomology at Michigan State University. The research he headed up was published in the journal Ecological Monographs. Hey, thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Veterans Day is this Sunday, November 11th, and this marks the 100th anniversary of the Armistice. As you might know, November 11th is not an accidental choice. It has to do with the date of the end of World War I. Back in 1990, a colleague of mine, Matthew Algio, and I had the idea that we should find World War I veterans and interview them before they were all gone. It took a while. This is the piece we put together, and it first aired in 1994.
No one who was not there could completely comprehend the horrors of World War I. For America, World War I was known as the Great War in Europe. for the first 3 years of the conflict. The United States got involved late in the war. It was months before U.S. troops landed in Europe. Even then, so few troops arrived, they were assigned to French and British units.
Americans, they wanted to end that war. They didn't want to be over there forever. We just enlisted for the duration, you know.
George Thorworth was among the U.S. soldiers who arrived early, landing in France in June of 1917. Thorworth, just as thousands of other young men in 1917, enlisted, volunteered. He felt he had a duty.
Well, they told us we was fighting for democracy, in a war to end wars. That was what they tried to brainwash the people with, you know.
America had been reluctant to get involved in the war. It was considered just another war in the centuries of wars in Europe. Before radio was in use, the U.S. commander, General John Blackjack Pershing of Missouri, made a recording to be played at town halls and fraternal meetings across the country.
3,000 miles from home, an American army is fighting for you. Everything you hold worthwhile is at stake. Only the hardest blows can win against the enemy we are fighting.
Patriotism in the U.S. began to run high. Small towns and rural counties put units together. Groups of young men in crisp new uniforms gathered to have their photos taken in front of the county courthouse or as they were marching to the railroad depot. Veteran Ray Fuller says there was no whining or complaining.
We just knew we had to go, that we got orders to go and we went. Of course, they was you were scared inside, undoubtedly, but you didn't. That didn't faze you. You just went.
In fact, while a military draft was called, much of the U.S. force volunteered. Working on his family's farm, William Halsey was 20 years old when the United States entered the war in 1917.
As soon as the harvest was done in the fall, I went over to Minot, North Dakota, enlisted.
Over there, send the word over there. That the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming.
Once over there, U.S. troops found the anticipated glory of battle was mired in trench warfare. Again, William Halsey.
The weather was so bad, you had no place to sleep on some newspapers if you could find some, or anything you could find to lay down on the ground. Tents you didn't have. Get a hole dug in the ground sometime, then it'd fill up with water.
Supplies were short. Relief was seldom. George Thorworth was first attached to the French Army, then the British, and when the U.S. had shipped over enough troops, he finally was assigned to an American unit. In each army, the soldiers faced conditions unimaginable.
We had our clothes pinned together, and just a pair of pants on and a little shirt, you know. I think we held the lines without a relief longer than any outfit over there. Of course, they'd ship us from one place to the other, wherever there's a hot sector. On Dead Man Hill there, about 260,000 got killed in one day on that one hill. It was 2 weeks afterwards before we tried to get out there burying them. You go out on patrol at night and you stick your arm into the dead bodies and stuff. It was terrible up there at that time.
In a war that saw at least 10 million people killed, death was a constant. Ray Fuller lost his brother in World War I and was injured himself. Although he spent a good deal of his time on a patrol a few miles behind the front, it still was not safe.
A shell came up. Company C was right behind us. They were from Wisconsin, a group. A shell hit right in the middle of the road there. The guys were laying in the road and all around there like that. I forget how many there was. There was quite a few killed, wounded. Boy, it was a mess for a while. Yeah.
The battlefield and weapons were new to the world. George Thorworth says chemical warfare, gas attacks, proved to be horribly effective.
I think most vivid one I can remember is the time I had a patrol out, and we had 260 men in the company, and there was only two squads left after the gas attack was in for 48 hours, and our gas masks weren't good for only about 24.
Thorworth says the battlefield was a mix of new technology and ancient warfare.
We used to get behind those big tanks. They're about half as big as this room here, you know. And we'd get maybe 15, 20 people behind that tank, and they were very slow. Go about as fast as you walk, that's about as fast as they go. And all our artillery stuff was drawn with horses at that time. When a horse get killed, we'd have slum to eat.
On the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, the armistice went into effect. Ray Fuller had been on the front 22 days straight when the fighting stopped.
naturally, you just celebrated. Wherever you could find a bottle of wine, they found it. Or anything else, they really celebrated that night. Yeah, you betcha.
But wine and women play the mischief with a boy whose looks is changed. How you gonna keep him down on the farm after he's been.
William Halsey and Ray Fuller became part of the occupying force. And although George Thorworth was in the trenches longer and fought more often than most Americans, because he was of German descent, he did not get to celebrate in Paris and take part in the victorious army. He was shipped home. Author Keith Robbins writes, "Huge numbers of crosses peopled the silent landscape. From all over the world in years to come, relatives and friends trooped through these uncommunicative cities of the dead. The cemeteries of Europe housed them, for in the end there was little to be said for trying to bring the fallen home. One mother concluded, it is just as near from France to heaven as from Indiana." This is Lester Graham.
Eyes of gold, star mother, sisters and brothers, what a sacrifice they made. I saw one-legged pals coming home to their guns. In my dream of the big
harvest. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Ever wonder what happens behind the scenes in a big-time campaign like the one for governor? Yesterday, in East Lansing, there was an opportunity to find out. Public sector consultants revived what's called the Pundits Summit. It basically analyzes the elections and looks to the future. One of the major portions of the conference was called Michigan Politics from the Front Lines. It included the manager of the Whitmer for Governor campaign, Eric Goldman, and Whitmer's communication director, Zach Pohl, as well as the Schuette campaign manager, Lori Wartz, and Schuette's communication advisor, Rusty Hills. Jonathan Osting of the Detroit News moderated that discussion. Here's part of it, which we lightly edited for time.
Rusty, you obviously have been involved in Michigan Republican Party politics for a long time, former chairman of the party, in fact. What dynamics did you see in the race this year that were unique, having observed so many of these for so long?
Well, you know, there's an old adage that you learn more from losing than winning. So if that's true, I'm the smartest pundit up here on the stage today, because I think I've lost more. I would start just by congratulating Eric and congratulating Zach and also, you know, your boss, the governor-elect. I thought you guys did a great job, and I thought she did a great job staying in the lane, staying focused, staying disciplined, and avoiding turnovers, avoiding mistakes, which sounds simple but is not in campaigns, as we all know, because you're being battered by so many things, right? What's happening in Washington, D.C., the national environment, primary fights, you know, just stuff that happens, and there's so many shiny objects that it's easy to get distracted. It's easy to get outside your lane. And I thought that was one of the keys to your victory, is that you guys did not let yourself get distracted. And I'm sure there were a lot of people coming to you say, because we get this too, right? Everybody's a campaign manager, right? I mean, maybe not here, but everybody I meet was a campaign manager saying, why aren't you doing this and why aren't you doing that? And what about the magnets for the refrigerators? And, you know, how blah, 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 and all that sort of stuff. And so, you know, I'd have people coming up to say, well, you know, why isn't she hitting you on Trump? And why aren't they doing this? And why aren't they doing that? But, you know, you have to pick a plan and stick with it. And obviously, you have to have a winning game plan. Right? We didn't quite get there because I think turnout was massive. And I think one of the things that I would argue is that if you look historically at what Michigan's done in these midterm elections, Republican bandwidth is sort of between 1.5 and 1.9. Democratic bandwidth is, you know, I fired Bernero down to 1-1, all the way up to 2 million under Jennifer Granholm, and you guys hit that mark, almost presidential-like turnout. And if you get up to that amount, I just don't think there's enough Republicans in a midterm election to get past a certain point. And I think, frankly, we did pretty well. I mean, given all the things that we faced in the tough primary, getting over to 1.8 million votes was quite a lot. If you had told me we were going to do that months ago, I would have thought we'd be in great shape. But when the Democrat turns out more than 2 million votes, pretty darn hard for a Republican to compete in a midterm.
Sure. Yeah, Zach, from the messaging side, Rusty mentioned, you know, there were questions, why didn't you hit them harder on Trump? Trump really wasn't part of the conversation out loud during the general election as much as he was during the primary. Were you guys tempted to go there, seeing some of his unfavorable ratings here in Michigan? And why weren't there television commercials with President Trump calling Bill Schuette the next governor of Michigan?
Sure. I mean, I'd say for starters, they did a lot of that work for us in the primary. They spent millions of dollars letting folks know that Bill Schuette was supported by the president, and frankly, we didn't need to waste a lot of our resources on that. We made a pretty early strategic decision that we had a message, both for the primary and the general election, that was going to resonate with a broad swath of the electorate, Democrats, independents, that, as Eric said, was very much focused on these kitchen table economic issues. I'm just speaking for myself here. I mean, I think one of the shortcomings of Hillary Clinton's campaign nationally, but in Michigan in particular, was sort of a lack of a strong economic message, and that was not a mistake we were going to allow ourselves to make. And so we knew that we needed to be disciplined, stick to a message that was simple and easy to understand, around issues that people care about every single day, fixing the roads, cleaning up our drinking water, making sure that everyone had access to quality, affordable health care. And once we made that decision, we stuck to it from start to finish. Our message really didn't deviate much from the primary after we won. And I think that was a big key to our success on Tuesday.
Now, Eric, I know you joined the campaign around March, is that right? So I'm not sure if you were on board then, but I'm curious from either one of you. When did the campaign come up with this slogan, "Fix the Damn Roads"? And what were those internal discussions like about, you know, pulling out essentially a swear word, in a gubernatorial campaign slogan? Obviously we saw the Attorney General Bill Schuette refer to it as "Fix the Darned Roads." I know in the primary, one of the other campaigns, somebody who worked for it asked me, "What do we have to do to get some attention? Say we're going to fix the effing roads." How'd you settle on "damn"? And was there any trepidation about using that in a statewide campaign slogan?
Yeah, you know, I think there was some trepidation. So we had, before we had started using it on television, I mean, it's been something that Gretchen actually said on the trail, "fix the damn roads." People responded to it. We released an infrastructure plan that, you know, we took a little risk on and called it the "Fix the Damn Roads" plan. You know, we ended up getting great coverage for it. And, I think people responded in a kind of excited way. I mean, you know, there's so much stuff going on nationally, so much stuff going on around the state, that especially in a primary, you're kind of fighting for oxygen. You're trying to get attention. And, you know, just talking about something in a way that's a little bit blunt, a little folksy, a little edgy, felt right. We never focus grouped it. We never polled it. We went on TV. We said it. There certainly was trepidation. Even some of our allies were like calling us up and saying, "What are you doing?" I think it was the 4th of July. Gretchen was walking in the 4th of July parade. People started screaming, "Fix the damn roads," to her. And I think at that point we knew that we were onto something, and that, you know, we were speaking about an issue in a way that resonated with people. We ended up doing a poll a few weeks ago before we went up on the air with "Fix the Damn Roads." And we asked people if they felt like the saying was something that was reasonable based on the state of the roads, or if it was something that was offensive, especially with children watching. And it was overwhelming that people felt like it was a reasonable saying and a reasonable slogan.
Interesting. I pushed to include a question on that in our public opinion polling, but wasn't successful. I was really curious how that was going to resonate with the public as well. Certainly memorable. I just warn you that a year from now, if people are still yelling "Fix the Damn Roads" at Gretchen Whitmer, that might be a problem.
Well, luckily we have a legislature which is committed to results, not resistance. And I think that working with a Democratic governor, we'll be able to get that done.
Lori, while we're talking about messaging, obviously for the Attorney General's campaign, Bill Schuette's gubernatorial campaign, he talked a lot about this paycheck agenda. He talked about repealing what he called, apologies, the Whitmer-Granholm income tax. How did you settle on that? And obviously that was something that you pulled out in the primary. How did you settle on that? And then did you consider evolving it, changing it for the general election? How do you approach that?
Well, I think we also knew that an economic message was an important message to get across, both in the primary and in the general, and trying to pave the way to the general by communicating that message early on in the primary. I think one of the key differences for our campaigns is that we had a very contested primary, and we took a lot of incoming with big dollars behind it. And so we wanted to layer over that messaging with Bill's independent record of accomplishment. I mean, he's, as Attorney General, there are a lot of things that he's done, a lot of successes that we weren't really able to communicate because we were responding to attacks in the primary that were attacks that not philosophical as much as they were, you know, politician or character or, you know, attacks that while a general election audience was listening. So, and even having to go, you know, message pretty strong on endorsements like the president's endorsement was something that, you know, we had to get through a contested primary. So that, so the message was, I think was a good message and a smart decision if we had had the ability and a kind of a clearer path through the primary where we didn't have to spend, more resources responding to attacks than we would have liked.
That was Lori Wartz, and we heard from Rusty Hills with the Schuette campaign and Eric Goldman and Zach Pohl with the Whitmer campaign. The discussion at the Pundit Summit was moderated by Jonathan Osting of Detroit News. In a lot of wealthier suburban cities, the cost of home ownership or rent is so high that the teachers, police officers, mechanics, and restaurant workers cannot afford to live in the city they serve. In larger cities where downtown living is becoming more popular, the rent is skyrocketing. In Detroit, some rentals that 15 years ago were affordable are now out of reach for middle-income families. The story is the same in Grand Rapids. That's led to a phenomenon known as the missing middle. Mark Norman is an associate professor of the Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning at the University of Michigan. He's here to help us understand the housing's missing middle. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So define missing middle for us. What does that mean?
Well, there are a couple of ways to define it. One is about the actual housing type. So traditionally, missing middle was the duplexes, the triplexes, the courtyard apartments, and the granny flats. And after World War II, a lot of cities basically zoned those out, said those were illegal to build. But those were some of our most affordable kinds of housing. And so a lot of people in middle and lower income brackets were sort of taken out of the market.
Forced out, you have to drive 20 miles to get to work now, things
correct.
Like that.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
You described the missing middle housing stock a little bit. What should it look like if these cities don't like the granny flats and the things like you just described? What should it look like in a city?
Well, I mean, I think it should just be diverse. And so we are in a situation now where a lot of housing is either single family or multifamily mid-rise. And so all of that other dynamic kind of housing, right, where you're living above a store or you're living in a granny flat or an accessory dwelling unit, or you have an apartment building and you live in one unit and you rent out the other, is something that actually creates affordability.
Zoning laws have a lot to do with the lack of housing for middle-income families, and they're so strict because the city only wants to attract nice developments that just happen to be expensive enough that only higher income folks can afford to actually live there. What can be done with zoning laws that would allow middle income people to live in the city again?
Yeah, I think it's really about being flexible. We had rooming houses, we had boarding houses, we had houses specifically for women, we had small apartments. Zoning, in many cases, can dictate that that can't happen anymore.
Well, let's talk about the practicality of that, because you and I know that when a new and different kind of housing development is proposed and people think that poor people are going to be moving in, there's outrage at City Hall, and they're protesting it, and city officials are saying, well, maybe we should rethink this. How are we going to get past that?
One thing is we need to maybe have new words for affordable housing, because I think it's come to mean in many people's minds public housing, which we don't actually even build anymore. And it also, I think, in some people's minds means some people that are different than they are. When in effect, affordable housing in Michigan is teachers, firefighters, waiters, bartenders. It's what I think most people would consider middle income if they actually knew what the definition was.
Developers who encourage housing such as you've been describing, duplexes and three flat apartments and things like that, they use the term density, which I think is one of the biggest PR blunders in the world of land use, because density sounds like those crowded 19th century tenements. So what do they really mean by density? How can you accomplish density without reminding us of those tenements.
Well, I think density, like affordability, probably needs some new words that make sense to people. So, for example, we're looking at downtown Ann Arbor, for example, incredibly dense in terms of other parts of the state, but not that dense. And so when you show people what, let's say, 20 units per acre looks like, it'll look very differently than it might be in their mind. So I think when we talk about density, we should probably put images to it so that people
like
see...
like pretty little row houses in the block or something
like
that.
For example.
Yeah. Yeah. Many times the land prices are so expensive that developers feel they have to go with high-end housing in order to make a profit. We hear that a lot. How important is that economic factor when looking at ways to provide the missing middle housing?
Land is a big part of the cost, but I think back to your point about zoning, we as cities actually can control the price of land. If we mandate that every unit needs two parking spots, we've just increased the price of land because that diminishes the amount of housing that can go on it. So I think we can actually make decisions through our zoning about how expensive the land is. If it's zoned for single family, then that land is actually more expensive. If it's zoned for 8 units, all of a sudden you get more units on that land, and each unit becomes cheaper.
I want to talk about some developments that have popped up recently in Detroit especially. Often there are these multifamily developments that are granted certain tax exemptions and other incentives, and in return, the developer is to set aside a certain fraction of the project for affordable housing. But often when I hear what the rent is actually going for, I'm wondering who in the world can afford affordable housing. That term, again, is really misleading, I think, because it depends on who you are. And even if you're making a median income in this state, you might not be able to afford the rent that they're asking for these things.
Yeah. It's a delicate dance because cities are negotiating for the most affordability while developers are looking at their bottom line. And so,
but we're giving them a lot of tax breaks, incentives, and so forth. I mean, can't the government leverage a better deal?
Cities need to be better negotiators. That much is true. I think the other thing is the way we determine affordability is through area median income. So, for example, in Detroit, that's a much wider area than the immediate location of the house. And so in some cases, while the income of people in the neighborhood might be $30,000 a year, the rent is calculated on a wider area, which might be $60,000 or $70,000 a year.
Hmm. Let's flip this a little bit. What are the consequences when a city is not looking for a way to provide middle missing housing? What's the worst that could happen?
Well, it just gets so unaffordable that people start driving until they qualify, as they say. So living further away to find that affordable housing and then increasing other costs like transportation costs.
I think some of the people in that elite city might be okay with that.
That's true. That's true. And so in places like California now, the state legislature is actually usurping power from municipalities in order for them to build affordable housing or more affordable housing than they're approving.
As we see in cities all over, we're still feeling the effects of redlining done back in the 40s and 50s. How does that play out today when we're talking about affordable housing and this missing middle?
It plays out in a number of ways. And there are a couple of books now that have really dug in on this topic, one called The Color of Law, which looks at historically how municipalities and federal programs zoned certain groups out of housing. And I think the long-term consequences our generational wealth was not created because people couldn't actually buy houses and live in neighborhoods where values were increasing.
So when a family's biggest asset is a house and they don't have that to pass on to their kids, it's a multi-generational problem.
It's a multi-generational problem.
One more question. When people start moving back into a city, what should cities be doing to help the people who actually live in those renewed neighborhoods and suddenly find they can no longer afford the rent?
I mean, there are a number of ways you can deal with that. Some cities do it through rent control, but others actually figure out ways to build more housing at more affordable prices and incentivize developers through better negotiations so that those rents are actually affordable for people that live there.
Mark Norman is Associate Professor of Practice in Urban and Regional Planning at the Taubman College of Architecture at the University of Michigan. Thanks for telling us about the missing middle.
Thank you.
Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Rusty Brock, who's wearing a stylish hoodie today. I'm Lester Graham. Have a great weekend.